From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the early hours this morning in eastern Ghouta in Syria. The Russian government had ostensibly paved the way for a brief ceasefire to allow for a so-called humanitarian corridor. Civilians have been suffering bombings there, and Russia had been pressured to stop it, forcing Bashar al-Assad's hand. For 5 brief hours, that was supposed to happen today, but Reuters and others now report that it did not. Despite Russia's promise, the bombing has continued apace. People continue to die there. Here's The Guardian responding to the news this afternoon. Quote, Bashar al-Assad, Syria's president, is primarily culpable. He probably no longer cares what the world thinks. He has no reputation to lose. Perhaps he calculates one final push by his ground forces will finish the rebels before a ceasefire takes hold. But the larger burden of responsibility lies with Russia. It was Vladimir Putin who rescued Assad in 2015 when he was losing the war. Russia's president has protected his Syrian poodle from war crimes charges and blocked inquiries into his use of banned chemical weapons. Putin has bathed in the kudos of seeming to supplant the U.S. as the Middle East's big mover and shaker. Well, Russia owns this conflict now, end quote. President Donald Trump has been hesitant to criticize Vladimir Putin and Russia, but he did over the past several days, and that has sparked a slew of pieces analyzing whether the Trump administration has been markedly different and perhaps tougher on Russia than the Obama administration. All of that goes on in the shadow of Robert Mueller's investigation. And if you have questions about that this hour, we're going to try to answer them. What we do know, what we don't know, what is speculation about Mueller's investigation and what is fact, and policy with the United States vis-a-vis Russia. We have a guest who can try to help us understand all of that. Randy Stone is back in studio with us. He's director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Randy, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
There is a lot to work through, and I guess I want to start with Mueller because there are some listeners who will say, well, that's all speculation. We won't know until, you know, Mueller fully lets us know everything he knows. And but I think you came in here willing to say there's a lot more than we at least can say that isn't just speculation anymore. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a lot that we don't know. We've seen the tip of the iceberg, and there's a lot of evidence that's still to be revealed. As one legal analyst mentioned over the weekend, Mueller is building a pyramid, right? And he is where exactly the tip of that pyramid will be is unclear. But we've already had a number of prominent people in the Trump campaign and in the Trump administration who have pled guilty to various charges. And those guilty pleas are very revealing. They don't yet draw a straight line to Donald Trump, but they do indicate that there was a lot of illegal activity going on behind the scenes and that it was broadly shared, and suggests that the Mueller investigation is going to be able to continue to push this investigation further. So in particular, George Papadopoulos pled guilty to lying to the FBI about Russian contacts and about being a go-between for the Trump campaign and with Russians. That was in October. Michael Flynn in December, he was the former National Security Advisor, very briefly, for the Trump administration. And before that, he was the Chief Foreign Policy Advisor to the campaign. Pled guilty to lying to the FBI about conversations with Sergei Kislyak, who was the ambassador from Russia. In particular, he lied to the FBI when he claimed that he had not discussed with Kislyak the proposal to delay a UN Security Council resolution that was condemning Israel. And he clearly was trying to get Kislyak to do that while before the Trump administration came into office, so that the Trump administration would be able to exercise a U.S. veto in the Security Council. And the Obama administration chose not to exercise a veto in the Security Council, in large part because relations between the Obama administration and Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel had deteriorated so much. The second thing that he pled guilty to lying to the FBI about was when he claimed that he had not discussed dropping sanctions against Russia in his conversations with Kislyak. So he clearly did talk about those two things. It's not quite clear whether those things happened in the same conversation and were a direct quid pro quo. So we don't know for sure whether he was offering to drop the sanctions in return for Russia delaying the vote about Israel. But that's implied. And then the latest thing that happened last week was that Rick Gates pled guilty to a series of charges, including conspiracy against the United States, which is a very serious federal crime, and lying to investigators. He admitted to conducting bank and tax fraud with Paul Manafort. Now, Rick Gates was the deputy campaign manager for the Trump campaign, and Paul Manafort was the campaign manager, and they had been business partners since 2006. They, according to the guilty plea, had laundered about $75 million in payments from Russia and Ukraine over a number of years through offshore bank accounts in Cyprus, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and the Seychelles. Seems like all these things always go through islands in yes. warm climates. And about $30 million of that came from Ukraine. We also know from this plea agreement that he's claiming that Paul Manafort used some of these offshore accounts to pay 2 million euros to former European politicians in a program called Super VIP. Now, the plea agreement does not name those politicians, but it identifies one of them as, quote, a former European chancellor. Now, there are only two countries that have chancellors, right? Austria and Germany. And this apparently refers to Alfred Gusenbauer, who was the former chancellor of Austria. Romano Prodi, who is the former prime minister of Italy, admits to having been paid by Gusenbauer. Now, he doesn't say where the money came from. Gusenbauer denies that he got money from Paul Manafort, but he admits that he met him two or three times, which is suspicious on its face, right? So that seems to be what we can infer from that is that they were probably some of the people who were involved in this action. So what that means is that former European high-level politicians were being paid to lobby in the United States, right? So that means that they're being paid as foreign agents because they're being paid indirectly by Russia and Ukraine using funds, right, that were funneled through these offshore accounts, which were cleverly hidden in order to avoid U.S. laws about disclosing campaign finance and the Foreign Agent Registration Act. Now, in addition to that, we've had charges brought against 12 Russians for running a very aggressive social media campaign on Facebook and Twitter and other platforms, which contacted hundreds of thousands of Americans and had a very dramatic impact. And we've recently seen reports in the press that independent studies have identified some automated, what they're called bots, right? These social media presences, which have amplified both sides of the reaction to the Parkland shooting. And so it appears that this campaign is ongoing. It's not aimed just at getting Donald Trump elected, although that was kind of an goal, apparently, of the Russian campaign. It is attempting to magnify every fissure in American society. It's trying to identify extreme tendencies and amplify them and turn Americans against each other.
This is an example, by the way, listeners, of what we talked about when we talked last week about the CNN reporting when they're contacting Americans who maybe unwittingly were planning events with the aid or even sometimes financial aid of these Russian groups. And one example was planning an event with the so-called pro-life and pro-choice factions. And the Russian groups would say, well, it's a noon meeting in the public square. They just want powder kegs. They want, as you said, Randy, they want division and they want to amplify it. not just in politics, but I guess everything is politics these days, but Parkland shooting is a good example. They want that high emotion and vitriol just flowing out there, it appears. But to what end?
Well, I think that the end is undermining trust in our institutions. So the one line of rhetoric that we hear from the Putin administration is very similar to one that we used to hear from the old Soviet Union, which was, well, we're really not that different. Yeah, we're a little corrupt. So are you. Yeah, you can't trust our media. You can't trust yours either. There's the effort to build moral equivalence and to do that by trying to undermine our faith in ourselves and our trust in our institutions and in our society more broadly.
Does President Trump play into that with his constant criticism of the media?
I think that's very damaging, yes. I mean, I think that there's there's room for criticizing particular outlets that make particular mistakes, right? But it's very important to the functioning of our democracy that we have a broad-based trust in the professionalism of at least certain media outlets so that we have a sense of where we can go to adjudicate certain disputes, and we can have productive discussions about how to deal with domestic and foreign policy problems rather than simply yelling at one another.
Listeners, if you want to call the program, we'll talk more about Mueller this hour, and we'll talk about some other things about U.S. foreign policy. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'd like, Randy, if you could, to kind of give me two ideas. The first is, if what we know now, what you just laid out being the case, Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, Rick Gates, the Russian, as the sort of the conservative media calls them, the Russian trolls, the dozen Russian trolls, if that is the extent, if there are no more tentacles that reach higher up in the White House, I'm curious to know what you make of the totality of that and if that is damning enough to be troublesome or worse for our country and for this administration. And I also like to hear, again, I don't want to overly speculate because I think it's important to be patient. But I do think it's valuable to understand what we very well may be looking at here. And if we can discuss it soberly, it's important. But there's a lot of complexity. Paul Manafort and foreign Austrian premiers. And, the American people, their eyes may glaze over a little bit as we follow the money from continent to continent, understanding who's doing what and why. If we can try to make the elevator pitch that this is our chief concern is that we may be looking at this, it is what? What is the worst case, the darkest picture that you can see is still plausible here?
Well, it is plausible that there was a deal between Donald Trump and the Russian government. Right, that you help me win the election and I'll fix our problems. Right? I will capitulate on Ukraine. We don't have evidence that that's the case directly. Right, the closest that we do have is that there was a meeting in June 2016 in Trump Tower, right, which was attended by Paul Manafort, Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law. And a number of Russians, including Natalia Veselnitskaya and Renat Akhmetshin. And that we know from Donald Trump Jr.'s emails, which he voluntarily provided to the public, that he agreed to that meeting because he was told that he would get intelligence from Russia that would be useful in the campaign for undermining Hillary Clinton, right? So There clearly was some collusion with Russia at the high level of the campaign. Now, this has not yet been proven in court of law, right? But a lot of it has been admitted publicly. We don't know for sure that Donald Trump Sr. knew about that meeting or was told about that meeting and so forth, but it's kind of implausible that he didn't. We don't know whether there was a direct quid pro quo. We do have a number of sources which are not yet in guilty pleas, right? So they don't quite have that level of credibility, but have their sources that have been vetted by the press and have appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times and so forth as allegedly credible sources, claiming that George Papadopoulos was a campaign worker, had contacts with high-level Russians, and that he was offered both a kind of a quid pro quo deal that involved dropping sanctions in return for assistance with the campaign, and also that threats were made, right? That the Russians had some dirt on Donald Trump. So those things have not made their way through the courts. We don't, that evidence hasn't been vetted in the same way as the things I mentioned earlier, which we know from plea accounts. But they were sufficiently credible that professional journalists were willing to publish them in very reputable news outlets. So it suggests that there's a lot more there. And we don't know for sure whether Michael Flynn's deal was, you know, a treasonous trade, right? You know, you do this for me about the UN Security Council, I'll drop the sanctions. But it may turn out that that's the case, right? There's more to learn. If all that ever comes to light is what's already been proven in court and pled to, then it does indicate that the Trump campaign was deeply corrupt, right? That it was being run by people who were criminals, Paul Manafort and Rick Gates, and that may not implicate anybody beyond them. Right. It does indicate that Russia was trying very aggressively to influence the U.S. election and continues to engage in illegal activity in the United States to try to undermine our institutions. So it means that we have a very serious problem with Russia, which I think we're going to have to confront. I don't know whether this administration is going to be willing or able to do that, but Russia thinks that it's waging an unconventional war against the United States. The United States hasn't quite figured out whether that's going on or not. And we're not sure how to respond. We're not sure whether the stakes are high enough that we have to escalate this to a different level.
Now, let me try to play devil's advocate here. When you say, number one, that it's implausible that the president, then candidate Trump, would not have known about the June 2016 meeting at Trump Tower, let me try to push back and say, and I don't say this to insult to the president. I'm just observing what we know about him. He's not a very sophisticated thinker on international policy. Is that fair?
I think that's true.
Okay. His base of knowledge of world events is probably at the very bottom of any president who's ever entered the office. He's just not all that interested and doesn't, you know, can't speak in a lot of depth about it. So is it plausible that he could have delegated some of the duty in his campaign to others, whether it's family members or advisors, et cetera, saying, look, I don't know about sanctions. I don't know about what's going on with Israel. I don't know about security councils. That's not my deal. You deal with that. I don't care what you got to do. That's not for me. Is it plausible that he was so unsophisticated in that thinking that he just didn't care to learn and delegated it and didn't know about that meeting?
So the June 2016 meeting,
yeah,
which involved his son and his son-in-law.
And his campaign manager, Paul Manafort.
Right. And then there's the meeting with Michael Flynn about the UN Security Council.
I want to get
to sanctions.
Flynn in a second.
That was in December.
Exactly.
Right.
So that was after the election.
Right. So I guess what seems implausible to me is that he didn't know what his own son and son-in-law were up to when they were dealing with something that was so important. They're deciding, well, can we have a meeting with Russians about getting the dirt on Hillary Clinton? It would be extraordinary for the candidate not to be aware of that sort of thing, even if two of his relatives weren't in the room. but the fact that his close confidants were in the room makes it very hard to believe that he didn't know.
Okay. Now, on the Flynn meeting, which happened in December, after the election, some of the argument, usually coming from conservative commentators, sounds something like this. Well, yes, he had that meeting, and he should not have lied about that meeting, but any incoming administration wants to do the groundwork, especially if they're going to change some courses, which they are allowed to do. So maybe Michael Flynn's charge was to tell the Russians, hey, we're not a big fan of how the Obama administration handled XYZ, whether it's sanctions or anything else, and we want to privately give you a heads up that these changes are coming. They were not inaugurated until late January, but just know that these changes are coming. And some conservative commentators have said, that's just basic diplomacy. What's wrong with that?
Well, the reason he lied about it is that it's illegal. You are not permitted to make foreign policy when you're a private citizen. And in this case, he was apparently negotiating using leverage that he would have as the incoming national security advisor to get a foreign power, Russia, to take action in the present, right, while Obama is still president. So he is using the fact that he's going to be working for the person who's going to be in office to undermine current American foreign policy, and that's specifically outlawed by federal law. That's why he lied about it, because he never would have gotten a Security Council or security clearance, and never could have become national security advisor had he admitted that.
Okay, and the hiring of Paul Manafort, who, if you know, listeners, if you haven't seen even the recent stuff on Paul Manafort, this is he was obviously a corrupt person before the events of the last 2 years, but he is a breathtakingly corrupt person. I think that's just objective, isn't it, Randy? I don't think that's controversial, is it?
Right. I mean, it's we don't have his own admission to it, but we have Rick Gates' admission to it. He was his business partner,
sure.
The amount that's specified in the plea is $75 million of money that was illegally funneled through various sorts of bank accounts to hide it. And at the same time that he was paying virtually no taxes because he was claiming not to have any income, he was buying houses in the Hamptons and so forth with this money.
And it's such a 2018 thing that Paul Manafort eventually gets in trouble because he needed help converting a Word document to a PDF, and it gets found out via email. So that's a story worth looking up separately if you want to Google that story. It's fascinating stuff. But even before all of that, and setting apart all of that, he had done work for some of the really awful characters in world history. And then we find out he's tangled up in all of this stuff. Is it plausible that Donald Trump thought he was hiring a really above board, high level thinker and nothing more?
You know, it's plausible that Donald Trump just made a stupid mistake or didn't pay attention because he has hired a lot of the wrong people for a lot of things. He doesn't know this business. He didn't have people he could go to run a campaign. The people he initially went to didn't turn out to be very good, and he fired them. So it's possible he had no idea how bad Paul Manafort was. What seems likely to me is that Paul Manafort was actually suggested to him. We'll find out eventually. Right, what this connection was, that he was actually suggested to him by one of his Russian contacts, because who would find it useful to have Paul Manafort in the center of the campaign? The Russians would, and Donald Trump already had extensive business contacts with Russians, and he has Russian oligarchs who have invested in his business, and he sells his townhouses in New York to Russian oligarchs and so forth. So it's likely, I think, that he found Paul Manafort through his business connections one way or another.
Let me get a phone call, and this is Allison in Webster. Go ahead, Allison.
Yes, I'm going to be on a more general topic with this, but when we were going to school, Americans were taught not to cheat. And if there's a cheating campaign going on, then all of them get dismissed. I'm hearing more and more people talking about treason. And I believe he has just the disruption that has been caused with him in office and him wanting to change the Constitution and all proves that he is treasonous to the United States.
That's a big word, Randy. Thank you, Elsa. That's a big word, Randy Stone. What do you think?
Well, I'm careful not to use the word treason lightly. I mean, it is a federal crime. It has a legal definition. I used it with respect to Michael Flynn, and it, hypothetically, right, that it could be established. It has not yet been established that what he's that his meetings with Kislyak amounted to treason. It depends on specifically what he said in those meetings. The president has broad discretion to do a lot of things, and the Constitution provides more protection for the president legally than for any of the people who work for him. So it is, I think it would be very hard to find a president guilty of treason, virtually regardless of what they did. But the relevant legal criterion isn't treason, it's high crimes and misdemeanors. And that's ill-defined, right? Exactly what that constitutes. It seems to me that when all this comes to light, we'll be able to put together a pretty strong picture that indicates that Donald Trump engaged in obstruction of justice, and that would rise to the level, is conventionally thought to rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors for which he could be impeached. Then it's another question whether that would actually happen. And, of course, that's a political decision, not a legal decision.
Caleb wants to know, do we have any guarantee that Mueller's investigation ends with a report of some kind?
No, actually, he isn't obligated to provide a report. He's an investigator, right? So his job is to pursue the leads and then decide which cases are worth bringing. So he has indicted a number of people, for example, Paul Manafort has not yet pled guilty, but he has been indicted. And these other people, Papadopoulos, Flynn, Gates, have all pled guilty already. So what we'll see is a series of court cases, not a report.
Okay. But to answer Caleb's question, even if it's not a singular report, I don't think all of the work that Mueller is doing is going to end in nothing. It's not going to end without at least some understanding of what he did and did not uncover. Is that, you agree with that?
I think that's true. That he's going to try to bring as much of this as possible to light.
We're going to back to your phone calls in 1 minute, but let me just sort of offer one more question for Randy Stone on this matter. He's the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Let's now turn our attention to the idea that maybe there was this, I guess the word would be collusion. And again, I'm trying, listeners, not to be overly speculative or to jump to conclusions. But I think it's also worth asking this. Would it be different in your mind if you had scenario A and B? Scenario A is collusion is that the Trump campaign decided, we are willing to work with the Russians. We want to win. We also have some ideas on sort of ceding power or at least giving them what they want because it's part of our worldview that we think the Obama administration has been wrong on this, that we sort of subscribe more to what Putin believes and, certain matters, and we will sort of sell out in that way. Versus scenario B, the campaign of a person who has always been about self-promotion and acquisition of power. And that's Donald Trump. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but look at the Parkland shooting. He meets with one of the victims, a teenage girl, and he says to her, I hear you're a big fan of mine. That's the first thing he says to a shooting victim. Everything is about him and the acquisition of power. And so maybe in this campaign, the idea was, let's win. Let's win if we can. Okay, well, the Russians say they can help. Okay, well, then what? Take what they got. But it was sort of bumbling. It was sort of unsophisticated. It was hazardous and problematic, but it doesn't come with a nefarious worldview. It comes with the promotion of self and the acquisition of power, and he got himself into a bit of a mess there. Does it matter if it's A or B in the end to you?
So I think the question there is essentially whether there's a transaction with the Russians that takes place, right? Whether there's a quid pro quo or not. Well, it matters in legal terms because different sorts of charges can be brought. If they accepted illegal help from Russia, then that's a very serious offense against our campaign finance laws. Right, so receiving intelligence from a foreign power that is valuable, right, is a form of a campaign contribution, which is forbidden by campaign finance laws. Coordinating with an ad campaign, right, that's run by a foreign power would be a violation of our campaign finance laws and so forth. So that would be one series of legal issues, irrespective of whether there was any sort of a deal made. If there's a deal made in addition, then you run into various sorts of legislation that prohibit private individuals from making foreign policy, right? And so that becomes another kind of problem.
All right. Our listeners want to talk about this, and I want to talk about some other things, but I know our listeners want to have a few questions on this. So let's go ahead and grab a few more. This is Mike in Geneva next. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. I was just wondering, with Donald Trump coming into the RNC, and the only campaign agenda that he really wanted to change was on Russian sanctions, and his inactions to enact the majority passed sanctions through Congress, is that something that down the road can be later proved to show quid pro quo, his inactions on Russia, his softness on Russia?
Well, we do know that the Republican Party platform was changed after Paul Manafort personally intervened in order to water down the plank about Ukraine. So that's been pretty clearly established. And I guess it's unclear whether Trump might have opposed sanctions against Russia even in the absence of Russian support for his campaign. I think it's plausible to think that that was consistent with his general worldview, where he because of his business dealings with Russians, he had a significant economic stake in those sanctions being removed. Right, so he had other reasons besides making a deal to remove those sanctions. So whether we'll be able to prove that there was a quid pro quo or not, I don't know. I think that's that may be difficult.
You want to follow up there, Mike?
Yeah. Well, then the other thing is, I guess I don't understand is how if Congress passes sanctions through Congress majority, and instead of using veto power, he just doesn't enact the law. How that is possible for a sitting president just to not enforce the laws if that's one of his main duties as president of the United States is to enforce and enact federal law.
Well, he is obligated to enforce the sanctions laws. What happened last August was that the sanctions that had been imposed by executive order. Right?
The Obama administration?
Under the Obama administration. And there's already a legal provision that gives the Treasury Department broad discretion to impose sanctions on particular individuals and institutions and so forth that are involved in certain kinds of behaviors. Anyway, there's broad discretion, and the Obama administration had used that. The concern was that the Trump administration would eliminate those unilaterally because they had that power under the existing legislation. So Congress passed a law that codified all of those things, made them much more difficult to eliminate. So it took away. It was an extraordinary thing. They took away discretion from the sitting president that had been written into the original law because they didn't trust Donald Trump on this.
Fox News' Shepard Smith reported on this, saying that Congress's vote, here are the numbers on Russian sanctions, 419-3 in the House, 98-2 in the Senate.
That's right. It was so overwhelming that there was no way that he could veto it. I mean, he would have been, he would have invited an override vote and so it would have been foolish to try to veto.
Shepard Smith brought those numbers up in response to a recent piece in The Federalist by David Harsanyi, saying that Democrats are trying to rewrite history by saying that Donald Trump has been soft on Russia. And Shepard Smith is saying, look, the White House made it clear. They didn't support that vote in the House and in the Senate. They didn't support codifying the sanctions against Russia this way. They didn't want that. Mm-hmm. But because of the overwhelming numbers, they were sort of disarmed about that. And Shepard Smith is saying that it took an overwhelming bipartisan act of Congress to get the codification of these sanctions that the White House did not want. Is that right?
No, that's correct. Right.
Okay. And so is that evidence then, the reason I'm bringing up this notion of, is this administration quote unquote tough on Russia, which is sort of this, really kind of nebulous term anyway. But I'm bringing that up because everybody now is looking for reason to say, well, look, if there was collusion, is the Trump administration acting XYZ as a result? Do you see an administration that is acting in a way that is either reckless or soft or strange in regards to Russia? Is there any smoke to that?
Well, I think they've actually backed off of what they intended to do because they realized that they were in hot water. And so their initial foreign policy thrust, one of the big novelties, was going to be doing something to improve relations with Russia. And they realized, wait, we are in the midst of a big investigation where we are suspected of having made a deal with the Russians. We can't change foreign policy on this front. So they've basically stuck with the parameters of Obama administration policy at the end of the Obama administration, which was to have a fairly tough response to the Russian invasion and occupation of Crimea and occupation of eastern Ukraine.
Interesting. So for all the talk about the differences, the Trump administration, in your view, has been sort of forced into a continuation, a status quo to some degree.
That's right. That's right. And foreign policy is usually very continuous, right? Usually maintains more or less the status quo from one president to the next. It's unusual when there are big innovations. Right? So incoming administration often plans two or three big initiatives, and maybe they get through those before they get overtaken by some international crisis, and then they have to react to that, and then the rest of their administration is playing catch up. So it's rare that there are dramatic innovations in foreign policy.
All right, so we're going to get our only break of the hour right here and come right back to that point, because the Trump administration has said that there are some big changes that they see with policy vis-a-vis Russia. And we'll take more of your phone calls. Mark in Greece, Sandra in Pittsford, we're coming to you. When we come back with Randy Stone, he is the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. This is our only break, and we're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, what would it take to convince you to buy an electric vehicle, not a hybrid, but an EV? Are you concerned with where you could plug in and charge? Well, there is a new workplace charging challenge in Rochester. The Rochester EV Accelerator is calling on companies to put charging stations at work to let employees know they can charge there. Would that change things for you? We'll answer your questions next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Mark in Greece. Next, go ahead, Mark.
Well, thank you. You know, for me, the really interesting question, above all these other amazing questions about Trump and Russia and collusion and all his cohorts with all these connections, is the financial. And if you could please comment on if you think that Mueller has gotten subpoenas for Deutsche Bank Private Banking Group, which is the only bank apparently in the world that's willing to loan money to Trump, and he owes $300 million to them. It's also a hotbed of Russian oligarchs that pays huge fines for laundering money to that bank, and the Cyprus bank connections. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mark. Go ahead, Randy.
Well, that's right. We know that the Mueller team includes very high-level expert prosecutors who have track records in dealing with international bank fraud and organized crime. And we haven't yet figured out quite what the organized crime connection is in all of this. But we do know that he's issued these subpoenas to financial institutions, including Deutsche Bank, and that he is trying to track these things down. So we may learn all sorts of interesting things about how the Trump organization functions and so forth. At this point, it's all very speculative as to what that will be. But it is interesting that, as you say, Deutsche Bank has these connections, has kind of become the international bank of choice for certain Russian oligarchs, and was at one point the only bank that was willing to make substantial loans to Donald Trump because he had defaulted so many times on his loans.
Ray emails the program to say, look up treason in the Constitution. Treason is aiding an enemy at war. The U.S. is not at war with Russia. Stop using this word. And I will just say, Ray, I'm as a journalist, I'm not saying anyone has committed treason. Not at all. I'm saying that's a big word, and we have to understand what it means. It's not something to throw around lightly. Randy, you want to clarify the point you were making there? Respond to that email?
Well, I think that we don't know the details of certain conversations. And so whether they might rise to that level, I think, is still an open question. The United States is not in a declared war with Russia. Russian officials have said that they're fighting a shadow war with the United States, that they see themselves as opponents, as enemies. They're trying to undermine our institutions and our cultural values. Now, this is an uncomfortable position to find myself in the 21st century, making this argument. And I remember how shrill and paranoid that argument sounded during the Cold War, when Americans would argue that the Soviet Union was somehow trying to undermine our institutions and our values and so forth. And the Soviet Union never had any ability to do that, right? We were terribly worried about some sleeper agents. Yes, our spies would shoot their spies and vice versa and so forth. And our spies are shooting their spies now and vice versa. But that it was never possible for the Soviet Union to represent the kind of threat of actually intervening in American political processes that Russia currently has. So it is a new kind of threat. It's a very serious, I would say, a very serious national security challenge, and the potential damage to American interests that can be caused by this kind of intervention is greater than the kind of damage that can be done by a Pearl Harbor type attack.
My observation is there's this interesting sort of divide on the American left and the voters who voted for Bernie Sanders and did not vote for Hillary Clinton, or had a lot of opprobrium for the Clinton campaign, are almost religiously devoted to the idea that the Russian thing is an entire hoax, that there is nothing there, and that all it is a way of obfuscating from a bad campaign that did not respond to the true needs of the American people. And I understand the passion among those voters, particularly among voters who feel like the Democratic Party has missed the point, and that the feeling is that whatever this investigation turns up, they want the Democratic Party to not miss the point, to not be able to say, well, see, it was all Russia, as opposed to it was not responding to the American economic needs of the people, the way the campaign was run, et cetera, et cetera. I think you have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And I think we have to just let Mueller do his job. He's a professional, and respect that, while also analyzing what does the country need. What does the Democratic Party, if you're in that party, where do you want to go going forward? And no matter what Mueller produces, to be able to separate those things. I think that, because it's just very interesting the way people have sort of devoted themselves to certain outcomes. And some are devoted to an outcome that we are, it's all treason, and that we know it's all treason, but we don't know. So I think it's prudent to be patient continue to be prudent and wait for Mueller to tell us more about this. But we do know there's some really rough, awful people who got hired in higher level positions in that campaign.
I think another really important conclusion to draw from all this is that we have to be very careful about how we consume social media.
Yeah.
And I hope that is a lesson that's drawn from this, that there are unscrupulous actors out there who are peddling a lot of misinformation on social media. And so you should not believe things that you see, that you get across social media, that don't come from reputable sources, and you should check whether they actually came from that source. So we know, for example, that the Twitter hashtag 10GOP, right, for Tennessee GOP, was not run by Tennessee Republicans. It was run by Russians, and it inflamed the campaign and circulated a lot of the most salacious falsehoods about Hillary Clinton that were broadly believed by the by Republican voters. We also know that certain handles that were claiming to represent African Americans were actually run by Russians. There one was called Blacktivist, another one was called Woke Blacks. And these were groups that assaulted Hillary Clinton from the left, argued that African Americans should not support her for various reasons, and that it would be better to stay home and not vote. Well, and that, you know, this was actually the perspective of white Russians who were trying to get blacks not to vote for Hillary Clinton. So this is really despicable.
All right. So before we have the hour evaporate on us here, because we could probably go all day here with Professor Stone. But I do want to get your take on that back and forth that we've seen commentators have, which is, you know, what was the Obama administration's net impact on policy with Russia? Has the Trump administration been, quote unquote, tougher? Here's David Harsanyi writing in The Federalist. He said, quote, Obama spent most of his 8 years placating Vladimir Putin and his allies in the Middle East. Much of the trouble we find ourselves in now can be directly traced to Obama's feckless policies. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind the history that the Obama administration came into office at a time when U.S.-Russian relations were really bad at the end of the George W. Bush administration, and they thought that they might be able to improve them. They tried what I think was a very pragmatic effort to improve relations in areas where we could find common agreement and not to link agreement anywhere to agreement everywhere. They made progress in a number of areas. For a while, it looked like a very successful policy, leading to arms control agreements, cooperation in Afghanistan. We supplied most of our logistical supplies through Russia for a number of years in Afghanistan because we couldn't get cooperation from our ostensible ally, Pakistan. There was a lot of cooperation. We got cooperation on Iran, right? That agreement never would have come about if it hadn't been for the fact that Russia was willing to support UN Security Council sanctions against Iran. All right, so there were a lot of dividends from that cooperation, but there was a dramatic turning point. I mean, it started in 2011 when there were some homegrown protests that rose up in Moscow. Vladimir Putin got scared. He blamed the United States. And he seems to actually think that the United States can somehow create domestic unrest wherever it wants to. So he blames all the unrest on the United States, and he thinks that the United States was out to get him in 2011. And so he became much less cooperative. And then that led him to make a number of bad choices, which led to the unraveling of relations with Ukraine, the overthrow of Yanukovych in Ukraine, its transition to democratic government, and then his invasion of Crimea. So by the time all that had happened, right, the Obama administration realized that the reset policy was in it was in tatters. We couldn't continue with this, and we had to confront Russia prevent or try to reverse its policies in Ukraine, its military intervention. So there was it seems to me to have been a policy that, you know, had good prospects, and with you know, had things worked out a little differently, could have been successful. We tested whether Putin was somebody with whom we could do business, and we discovered, well, he really wasn't. And I don't see much prospect for improvement in U.S.-Russian relations in the near future as a result. But the end of the Obama administration was really very tough on Russia in response to Ukraine. It was calibrated toughness. There were always additional actions that they could have taken. When they imposed the sanctions, they realized that they could have brought about a financial crisis in Russia, and they chose not to, because Russia is a dangerous country to push too far.
I wish we had another hour. I feel like we're really just getting going. Will you come back soon? I appreciate it.
It's good to be here, Evan. Thanks.
Randy Stone is the a somewhat frequent guest who really helps us see these matters as best we can and understand the world, and he's director of the Skelny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Always good to have him. Listeners, if we didn't get through with your phone calls and emails, please keep in mind we'll continue these conversations because it's the world we live in. So much more to come on that and much more connections straight ahead. Stay with us.